It is now 8 o'clock, according to my clock. So it is beholding on me to give the morning Dhamma talk. Maybe. The future is always uncertain. And that is something which Ajahn Chah always impressed upon me. Because I recall, I think I mentioned earlier about the ceremony we would have every year in the full moon night of February called Maka Puja in Thailand. And that was such a huge ceremony that in my fourth year as a monk, I, together with every other monk in the region of disciples of Ajahn Chah, would descend upon the main monastery. There was maybe 1,000 monks, or maybe 1,000, maybe 500, a lot of monks. And that had 10 times as many lay people, probably more. Huge congregation. And after the evening chanting, it was time for Ajahn Chah to give his talk. And of course I was waiting for that too. But such was the unpredictability of the great master that sometimes he would choose one of his other senior monks to give the talk. And what he would do, he would look down the line of monks and he'd usually say, oh, Ajahn Lir, Ajahn Chan, you go and give the talk. But sometimes he would go further down the line. And this was one of those occasions. He looked all the way down the line of monks, getting closer and closer to me. And the closer he got, the more worried I became. And then he looked at me and he went past me. And I sighed a deep sigh of relief. And then his eyes started coming up the line again. And guess where they stopped? Brahma Wangso, get up and give the talk. For 1 hour, in Thai, in front of your teacher, and so many other lay people as well. You had to do it. You had no choice. That was how I was trained. And so, being a good student of my teacher, well, I know I won't get away with that here, so you're safe. You don't have to run out of the room quickly. But it was a nice little training in dealing with the unexpected. And also didn't worry, didn't matter. Because the way we were taught, you didn't have to give a good talk. Or a bad talk, or in between, it was just a talk, that's all. So you never judged yourself. And no one else would judge you. Ajahn Chah wouldn't give you a pat on the back. That's my boy. Great talk. No, you'd never do things like that. He'd just go away and just ignore you. After all that effort you put in. And it was part of the training that you would never expected to know what was going to happen next. You couldn't expect. You didn't know what was going to happen next. And it was so unpredictable. But also, it was no judgment. And so, for me, even starting to give talks, some people think that I was born as a good Dhamma teacher. But I still recall, many of you know this lady, she was one of my chief disciples over in Singapore, you know, Angie Monksfield. And she came to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery several years ago. And she was getting a bit bored, so she went up in the library and looked for all the record of all the talks which I'd given, and especially the very, very, very old ones, which were done on cassette tapes. And she found the oldest one she could. When I just came to Australia and was giving talks in our first centre in Magnolia Street. And she got that out and she played it, and she came to tell me her reaction afterwards. She said, "That was the worst talk I've ever heard in my life. That was so boring. That was just so uninteresting." And she was laughing all over her face, and so was I. I said, "Yeah, that proves it. You know, you don't have to, you know, be a good speaker. You just give it a try and see what happens. And you learn on the job. And in fact, you've got nothing to lose as a monk or as a nun. Because if they like your talks, wonderful, you're inspiring other people, that gives you so much happiness. And if they hate your talks and all walk out the room, that's even better. You never have to give a Dhamma talk ever again. You can be free of all of that. Either way, you win." And that's always been my philosophy. I learned from Buddhism, from Ajahn Chah, you've got nothing to fear. Just already mentioned, you're sick, you either get better or you die. What's the problem? Sickness doesn't last. Meditate, you have good meditation, bad meditation. What's the problem? In fact, that was one of the first teachers, said there is no such thing as bad meditation. He never said this, but he also meant no such thing as good meditation either. Why do we always get into this terrible delusion of judging? This is a good meditation, that's a bad meditation. Who are you to say? Have you not noticed, those of you who come to the interviews with me, and you tell me, you've been fantasizing, you've been plotting to murder that person in your room who's always snoring and banging the teacups at 2 o'clock in the morning. And what do I tell you? I said, "Very good." Have you ever noticed me always say "very good"? No matter what. So I've been sleeping, I've been really restless. Done no meditation, and also just in the afternoon when I'm not supposed to, I sneak into the kitchen when Bianca's not around and I eat something. And what do I say? "Very good." Now that's not encouraging you. That's not giving you permission. But all it is I try not to judge you. Because that's a very powerful, deep meditation teaching. Don't judge. Judging is comparing. Already you're in the future or the past. Usually in the past. Comparing this meditation now with the one which you had when you first came here. The first day or two, or the one you had last year. Remember that really beautiful one you had 25 years ago? Why do we compare and judge? You can't. Every meditation is totally unique. It is one of the reasons why that I mentioned to one person in the interviews, one of the most fantastic meditation methods. I think I mentioned it, I think the first night. It's absolutely brilliant, but so simple. People like Anapanasati, Satipatthana, something complicated, something you could get your intellectual mind around to give it something to chew on. When you've got nothing to chew on, you get very frustrated. But this is so simple, it's the Empress Three Questions meditation. All those little stories you put down in that little book, opening the door of your heart, people think, "Oh, that's just a kid's book. For me, I want Abhidhamma. I want the really about jhanas, describe limiters and why they come and where they come from and the psychology of this." But most of the very deepest teachings you miss because they're so easy. And that is one of the most profound. Now the most important time. So it means give now importance. Later on, don't give that importance at all. The past is totally irrelevant. It is unimportant. So don't even think about it. Don't say, "Oh, this is not as good as it was yesterday." What are you talking about? You're demeaning this present moment. Have you ever been stigmatized because you're too fat or too thin, or you know, you're Asian in an Australian school, or because you've got some little deformity, like you've got a limp, or there's something else, you know, you keep twitching your eye? Have you ever been stigmatized for just what you can't do anything about? Look, when I was a school teacher, I had hay fever. I should not have gone to school. So I was trying to teach some physics, and I was... And in 5 minutes, I had 30 children, about 14-year-olds, all looking at me going... They were so cruel. I could only go mad. I was trying to teach. Anyway. But why are people stigmatized? And why do you stigmatize this present moment by saying it's not as good as the moment which happened a few moments ago, or yesterday, or the day before? So we have this beautiful attitude, even in meditation, which incidentally, it just flows over to your normal life. You don't judge people. You don't judge anybody. That's why I always say very good, no matter what you do. That's being a non-judgmental. Open the door of the heart to every one of you, no matter how stupid and dumb and stubborn you are. But you're fine also. So, what we do is, now this is the most important. Nothing else matters compared to this moment. So we really up the importance of this moment. And there, you actually can stay here. So I often say, now is the moment your future is being made. If you wonder about what you're going to do when you get home, this is your home, this moment, right now. It always has been. Your home is wherever you happen to be, now. So going off into the future or past is actually running away from your real home. So, give this moment throughout the whole of your life importance, real importance. You get this moment right, and the future usually looks after itself, because this is where your future is made. And also, this becomes your past. If you're interested in the past, start making some good moments now. Then you look back, oh, I had a wonderful time at Jhana Grove. Oh, I remember that time. Because you were here, enjoying it, putting all your attention in this moment. So simple. And if you ask, where does that have any reference in the Buddhist suttas? That's in the Baddhekarata suttas, the importance of the present moment. The Buddha discovered that long time before Eckhart Tolle. Eckhart Tolle, like most of these, they all take it from the Buddha. But anyway, the power of now, Baddhekarata Sutta. But the next thing, the most important thing in the world, and this is where people really lose it in meditation, they're always thinking that jhanas are more important than the breath, or nimittas. Those are really the juicy ones. So whatever you're experiencing now is just a means to an end. It's not the end itself. Instead of making this moment, whatever it happens to be, the most important in the world. So if you're frustrated, frustration is the most important thing in the world for you. Be here. Understand it. Learn from it. Like I said last night in that anecdote of Ajahn Mahabua, tough monk, the teacher of the late king of Thailand. He was scolded by his teacher, Ajahn Mun, for fighting things, trying to get rid of things. He said the job, the task, the duty of a meditator is not to fight anything, but to investigate it, to be with it, to explore it, to understand it. So you don't try and get rid of frustration, no more than you try and get rid of your fever. You're there investigating it, making it important, learning from it. Every experience which you have in life is there to be learned from. So don't throw it away. Yeah, it may be painful, unpleasant, but you learn so much from that. That again was what Ajahn Chah meant by Ajahn Mosquito. It's unpleasant, but you learn so much. They're important for you. If they weren't there, you wouldn't be the monk you are today. The short story of that, I've said it so many times. Why is it important? You want to get rid of the pain, the problems, the suffering. But what is the suffering? It is the dog shit. And what do you do with dog shit? You take it home with you, all the way to Canada, if you can get it through biosecurity. And you dig it under your apple tree, or maple tree. Maple tree, because then you get the most sweetest maple syrup ever before. Which somebody just gave me a bottle of maple syrup, the real stuff. So when I go to Canada, you can give me the maple syrup coming from your maple tree, which has been fed on the dog shit, which you got from Bodhinyana Monastery in Australia. So delicious, sweeter than ever before. Because the idea is that everything, the unpleasant stuff, is fertilizer. Fertilizer for your eventual, your parameters, if you like. Your wisdom, your compassion, your deep understanding, your ability to be with stuff, instead of always trying to get rid of it. Trying to get rid of things, that is a defilement. That's a hindrance. Trying to get rid of stuff, I don't like it. So how come we don't notice that and we keep on encouraging the hindrances? I am fed up. And we get aversion to being fed up. Instead of investigating it, being with it, letting it be. It is important. You obviously find out, this is some basic psychology, if you keep trying to suppress it, get rid of it, you don't understand it, it keeps coming back again and again and again. You haven't dealt with it. So we let it come up, we let it be. Whatever it is, we don't judge it. It is important. Whatever's in front of you right now is the most important thing in the whole world. And giving it importance, giving it value in this moment, that's my definition of mindfulness. In other words, we're not trying to get rid of things. We haven't got like one eye here and another eye where we're going to be later on in life. We're focused right in this moment. And if giving it importance, it's easy to focus. When you think, oh, I've got to get rid of this to get something better, then you will never be happy in your life. You'll be in Jakarta, and I don't like Jakarta. You want to get rid of that to get somewhere better. You will have this amazing boyfriend. Oh, I'm going to get rid of him to get something better. I've got this amazing job. I'm going to get rid of this to get something better. I've got this stupid body. I'm going to go to Bangkok and have plastic surgery. Is it Bangkok or is it Korea? I'm going to go to Gangnam and get some plastic surgery. Apparently all the best plastic surgeons are there now. I'm going to get rid of my husband and get something better. I'm going to get rid of my car and get something better. I'm going to get rid of my monastery and get something better. This place is too old now. I'm going to go. And you notice that is just so demeaning. And instead, we learn to be content and value and give importance to what we have. The husband you've got now is the most important in the whole world. Can I convince you of that? No. If it's right now, that's the only one you've got. So look after it. Care for it. Which is the third part. To care for this moment. And that caring, giving importance, you'd be amazed at how that makes meditation, number one, easy and gets really deep. If you don't give it importance, but you give it aversion, I want to get rid of this. Of course, you can have no peace at all. If it's important, number one, you're really looking at it, and if you're caring for it, it gets really nice and soft. Hard to find similes, but I came up with a simile once about like present moment awareness and giving it importance and caring for it. It was like a simile of going on a journey. You're walking through the hills or the mountains somewhere and you get really tired and hot and you're really looking for a place to sit down and rest and go no further, just to stop for a while. And the only place you can find is this stone bench, which is cold and hard and rough, but it's all you got. So you sit down on it. And the longer you sit on that stone bench, the warmer it becomes. The longer you sit on it, the softer it becomes. The longer you sit on it, maybe because you're fidgeting, the smoother it becomes. And after a while, is like sitting on a comfortable sofa. And that is like present moment awareness. When you first sit on present moment awareness, sometimes it's hard and cold and uncomfortable. But the longer you sit there, the softer and more comfortable it becomes. So give this moment importance. It's not a case of endurance. Give this moment importance, care for it no matter what it is, and it becomes soft and warm and comfortable. Which is why, if you stay with whatever it is you're experiencing now, stay with it, it transforms it. Why? Because you are making good meditation karma. Karma, basic teaching of Buddhism. We always think it's what we do so we can be happy later on. Yeah, but it's also this meditation karma as well. What we're doing with what we've got right now, which gives beautiful meditation results later on. And good meditation karma. The Buddha said again and again, the essence of karma is where you're coming from. If you're coming from the three wholesome roots, letting go, kindness, wisdom, then it's always good karma. In fact, it was refined in the Eightfold Path, the second factor of the Eightfold Path. Right motivation, where you're coming from. That defines what good meditation karma is. Wholesome, useful meditation karma. And that is the three right motivations, Sammasankappa. Letting go, nekama, it's like renunciation, letting go, kindness, avayapada, and gentleness. And when I see that, and when I apply that to meditation, meditation just takes off. You find because you're not practicing right motivation, where you're coming from. You're trying to get something rather than trying to let go of things. You're not renouncing. You're just getting more attainments for your ego, for yourself. You want to go and tell people how many retreats you've done. Look at me, I've done retreats with Parhok Sayadaw, I've done retreats with Mahasi Sayadaw, I've done retreats with Ayakema, I've done retreats with Ajahn Brahm. I've done retreats with Bhagavan Rajneesh. That was fun. I was done retreats. And you just say how many retreats you've done. And then you say what your attainments are. I'm going to tell this story, which I usually tell every retreat. Told to me by a Sri Lankan man in San Francisco a couple of years ago. It was in Colombo, Sri Lanka. There was a really dodgy organization of Buddhists. And they were holding retreats, but much longer than this. And not just meditation, study as well. You went to classes, you meditated, you discussed. It was like a university, but with meditation involved, for about 3 months. And at the end of the retreat, you were given an exam. Tested. Meditation, knowledge of Dhamma. And the board of trustees, whoever they were, they would assess you. And on the basis of their assessment, you would be given a certificate. An enlightenment certificate. Streamlining, once returning, non-returning, even full enlightenment. They gave certificates to prove I am a streamliner. So on, look, I've got the certificate, it's signed underneath. Because who can believe you? You know, you might say anything, you might be crazy, but this is a certificate. Just like if you've got to go work anywhere, you know, you've got to get your education certificates, your A-levels or your year 12s, the bachelor's degree or anything else, your B2 engineering classes, you've got your certificate of the Australian Institute of Engineers, whatever it is. People love certificates. But I don't have any certificates. I've been telling a lot of people these days that meditation is very popular now. Mindfulness, you can go into town and do courses on mindfulness. But you have to be an accredited teacher. You have to have a certificate before you can teach mindfulness. So I'm illegal. After a while, they won't allow me to teach meditation anymore because I haven't gone through any of these courses. I don't have any certificate. So my time as a meditation teacher is numbered. It's good you're getting here quickly while I can still escaping the accreditation. Isn't it crazy? You have to be accredited before you can do anything. So anyway, they had this group of accrediting people. And there was this old auntie who lived up in the middle of Sri Lanka, really in the whoop-whoops, up in the mountains, in a small village. You know, just, you know, those of you in Sri Lanka know those places, know those old aunties, really cute and sweet, would help anybody, would always go to the temple for the ceremonies and do her chanting and lighting the oil lamps and stuff. But when she went to visit her relations in Colombo, these were the ones who were educated, you know, the snooty ones. And they, for some reason, even meditators do not look down on these village monks or these little old ladies in villages. Sometimes we think, they don't know anything about Buddhism and meditation. And sometimes you get so surprised. I remember that story of, I'm just going off on a tangent before I go back to Colombo, back to Ajahn Chah's monastery. There was a young monk came to stay for a couple of days, but he was a village monk. He was wearing the bright yellow robes. So people judged him. Bright, he's only a village monk, he's not serious. And so they just let him stay in the hall for 3 days, and they ignored him. And he's not like us, he probably keeps money, probably watches the TV, you know, he's not a real monk. So they didn't pay any attention to him. So he just left after 3 days. And one of the monks saw him later on in another place and had a chat with him. Oh yeah, I went there because, you know, I was getting second jhana regularly and I wanted to understand how I could proceed from there. They totally underestimated him. He was a really, really good monk. They were really getting into deep meditation. But because they judged him on the clothes he was wearing, they thought, he's no one. Never ever judge anybody like that. So they judged this little old lady from the middle of Sri Lanka somewhere. And they were kind to her. They let her come on this retreat. Oh, their family paid for her to go on this month's retreat. And yeah, she did really well. A lot of faith, very simple, didn't think too much, didn't ask so many questions. And they had grown up with Buddhism. So, you know, even the examination, she just knew that from a child. So, when they came with the results, they came and gave this certificate to this old lady. Congratulations, Auntie. Oh, you have been doing so well. We're pleased to say that we've judged you, we've looked at you, and we're pretty sure, so sure we can give you this certificate. You are a stream winner. So on the first stage of enlightenment. Only at most 6 more rebirths, never going back to a lower realm, assured of full enlightenment. Congratulations. At which the auntie got very upset and got angry. She wasn't happy at all being told she was enlightened. And they said, why? This is an amazing achievement. You're a first stage of enlightenment. Why are you saying here's a certificate to prove it? And she said, you don't remember me, do you? No, we don't. Who are you? I was here 3 years ago. And 3 years ago, you gave me non-returner certificates. You've demoted me. That's why I'm upset. Look at that. You don't give certificates away. In fact, anyone who wants a certificate shows they're never a stream winner. You know, you're disappearing, your ego's going, you're letting go, you're renouncing. So, you don't go around. Like, you know, I don't go around saying, Ajahn Brahm, a great meditation teacher, thousands of people come and see me, because sometimes people don't know who I am. I love that. I was in Vietnam some years ago for a conference, and when I was in, what was it, just outside of Hanoi somewhere, and on one of the sessions, you know, I don't speak at every session, you just go and listen to what other people say. It's really rare for me to listen to someone else's Dhamma teaching. Because wherever I am, I'm always the one who gets on the scene and has to teach. So I enjoy it, listening to other people. So I was sitting in the back there, just waiting for the presenters to come up on stage. And another monk, young monk, came and sat next to me and just chatting, spoke really good English. So, where are you from? I said, I'm from Australia. Oh, really from Australia? You wouldn't know this monk called Ajahn Brahm, would you? That was such a sweet moment. I looked at him and said, I am Ajahn Brahm. Ah! He said, he actually exploded. Ah! Oh, that was really good. I really enjoyed that. So it does have some benefits. Or like my nephew, I'm just telling anecdotes this morning, I hope you don't mind. My nephew came to visit me, my brother's son, and he went through Vietnam, and on the way from Vietnam to Singapore for a few days and then come to see me in Australia. And when he was going through the customs in Singapore, in Changi Airport, they found at the bottom of his backpack there was a used bullet shell. It wasn't live, it was just a shell. That showed up in the x-ray. Come over here, sir. So he was taken in one of these rooms. That's a serious crime in Singapore. You know, to have a, you know, it's not a live bullet, but a bullet shell. It counts as ammunition. And dressed in Singapore, terrorist. So he said, did you know you had a bullet shell? No, I don't know how it got there. I don't know, I was backpacking with people. I'm not quite sure where that came from. That's really illegal. You know, you're in big trouble. Oh, well, I'm terribly sorry. It's not live. I'm not going to kill anybody. He said, what's the purpose of your trip? Why are you going to Australia? He said, I'm going to see my uncle, my monkle, who's a Buddhist monk. And the guy interviewing him, interrogating him, said, ah, oh, does your uncle know the monk called Ajahn Brahm? And my nephew said, he is Ajahn Brahm. Oh, really? I've listened to his talks. He's really helped me. Okay, off you go. And I got my nephew off the hook. So it does help sometimes. But anyway, who cares? Anyway, sometimes I'm Ajahn Brahm, sometimes I'm not. So, when you understand about renunciation, you're not trying to attain anything. What are you trying to get anyway? So if you get jhanas, so what? So you get enlightened. What's that going to do for you? If you don't know how to let go and disappear, it's not about you anymore. So you don't judge. You are letting go of such things, good and bad. And then the kindness, no ill will, whatever's in front of me right now, that's really important. So I'm kind to my stupidity. I'm kind to, okay, here we go again. Ajahn Brahm's stupidity. To show how dumb I really am. In Kuala Lumpur, last December. In Kuala Lumpur last December, giving a retreat, and this couple came in for their interviews, and a guy and a girl. And the girl did all the talking, and at the end of the interview, you know, I looked at them, I said, the guy never said anything at all. That was one of the reasons I thought that must be your boyfriend, because he was so quiet. That's supposed to be funny. The girl did all the talking, so I thought it must be boyfriend. And she looked about in her early 20s, he looked maybe 30s, or even maybe mid-30s. And that's when I said, oh, is that your boyfriend? And she just burst out laughing, and so did he. And she said, no, that's my dad. But it worked, because she was actually only 16. But, you know, when I said, oh, that's, you know, that's your boyfriend, it made her feel that she was much older than 16. And if you tell a 16-year-old she looks like about 23, 24, 25, she really gets into that. That's cool. That's awesome. Thank you so much. And when her dad, who was in his 40s, when I thought he was young enough to be his daughter's boyfriend, he was really pleased with that. Do I look that young? Oh, thank you so much. And then 5 minutes later, they came in again with a donation of $100. I really cleaned up on that one. So my mistake. It's flattery. People like to be flattered. But not like that time when I was doing a wedding blessing in Nolamara, and this young Thai girl came in. Now, she really was young, like 20, 21, really young. And she was accompanied by this old guy, old Australian guy. And I said to this old guy, I said, oh, you're the father of the groom. That was a big mistake. He said, no, I am the groom. I didn't get any donation for that one. So I make stupid mistakes as well, but you let them go. You don't look upon this as a personal failing or a personal attainment. It is, you let it go. Life is much more fun when you don't get a self in the way. This also means you're attaining anything. What are you doing? You can't get frustrated, you can't get disappointed, because you're not judging anything. So, whatever it is right now, it's important. Be kind to it. Care for it. And it gets really nice and soft. And you're just making peace. Another word for letting go. Being kind, being gentle. Now this is where we get one of the most powerful teachings of the Buddha about learning how to deal with the problems in life. And that is the great simile. I haven't said it yet, but it's a beautiful simile used in so many different ways of the monster who came into the emperor's palace simile. And many of you heard it so many times, but hopefully you've practiced it as many times as you've heard it, because it really, really works. And that is empress. I always use an empress these days because no gender equity. Why do all presidents, prime ministers, emperors have to be guys? So this empress, she was away on a meditation retreat, where into her palace came this really ugly, terrifying, stinky, violent monster of a demon. Okay, right inside. Now we do have security staff, but you know, sometimes security staff or police, they're not really what they're sort of hyped up to be. I remember being in Los Angeles, just being taken to the airport, when there was actually a terrorist scare in LAX. Someone had gone up to the Korean Airlines counter and said they had a bomb. And so the police car, just, you know, full speed, driving down the road, slammed on its brakes, and right in front of me, the doors opened up, and these two policemen came out with machine guns, you know, and they ran up the stairs, the higher level where I go into the departure. I forget what level it was anyway. And they ran halfway up the stairs with their machine guns, and they had to stop. Panting. They were so unfit. They were fatter than I was. And this was supposed to protect the airport from terrorists. If any terrorists had seen them, they'd burst out laughing. But this is what you said to catch us? Come on, get real. And if only you'd have one of those mobile phones and video, that would have gone viral. That would have just totally obliterated just the prestige of the Los Angeles Police Department. These two policemen. Only just one flight of stairs, only got halfway up. Wasn't that high. And I had to stop to catch their breath. Crazy. But anyway. Where was I going with this? I forgot where we're going. Yeah, okay. Sorry? Emperor's questions. Yeah, okay, the security, that's what it was. Thank you so much. Please don't judge me. The Emperor's secret. The Emperor's palace. So the Empress was away. When she came back, the security, just they hid. You know, they tried to run up the stairs, so they panted, so they couldn't stop this demon. And right in the palace, right, and sat on the emperor's throne. Now imagine someone did that in Thailand, in the king of Thailand's throne. They just went in there and sat on it. That would get really upset. So that was going a bit too far. So the security, they came out, you know, from under the tables, from behind the flower pots where they were hiding. They came out and said, get out of here! Who do you think you are? You don't belong here. That's our emperor's chair. You can't do that. That's wrong. How was that anger?
Good, okay. Because it's as a monk, especially as a senior monk, I keep saying this, you're not allowed to get angry. You know, you are so privileged, you can shout out there, get angry. I can only act it out. So every opportunity that I have, you know, to act it out. Get out of there, yeah. It's really quite enjoyable, instead of being peaceful all the time. Makes a change from being equanimous. So there we go. Get out of here, you don't belong. And at that, the monster grew bigger. More ugly, more terrifying, and more smelly. And that just really upset all the people in the palace. They just threatened this, they threatened that. And that just made the monster bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and more of a problem. And that was when the empress came back from her retreat. So peaceful, she just wafted into the palace. And she took one look at this incredible, powerful, stinky demon. And, oh, I must remember, that's one of the best pieces of writing I've done, was when it was so smelly, this demon, that even the maggots crawling on the demon's skin threw up. They vomited. They puked. If the stink can make maggots from it, that is smelly. That's disgusting. Because maggots have got a very high tolerance level for bad smells. They live in bad smells, so this must have been really stinky. But the empress, she knew exactly what was going on. Why? Because her retreat had been in Jhana Grove, where you get all the best teachings. I Will Let Go by Ajahn Brahmari, from the suttas. So, came in there. She knew what to do straight away. A really ugly, terrible monster demon, eyes bulging out. Welcome, monster. Thank you so much for dropping by for a visit. Why have you waited so long to come and see me? Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet? We've got beautiful Sri Lankan tea with condensed milk made by Suwadi. Delicious. Mmm. Or would you like something healthy? We've got peppermint tea for you. And at that, it wasn't messing around. She was sincerely kind. And at those few kind words, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly. And everyone in the palace saw and understood. So instead of saying, get out of here, you don't belong, they started to be kind to this monster. They asked it what it would like to eat. And the obvious thing for a monster that size was a pizza. Monster size. Because apparently you can get monster-sized pizzas in Australia. And so they ordered a monster-sized pizza. And some of the others said, sorry, it's huge feet. And had about 2 dozen of them decided to give the monster reflexology. A foot massage. Oh, that was so nice. It's so rare for an ugly, terrifying monster like that to get a foot massage. You try that the next time you're in Thailand to see a tiger. I'll give you a foot massage, tiger, and oh, that tiger will be just so, oh, just over there, oh, that's really nice. And every kind act, kind word, kind deed, the monster grew an inch smaller. That's no problem. Until it got so small it was the size when it first came in the palace. But they carried on with the kindness until the monster became so small, much smaller than when it first came in. But one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. It just vanished. And that is based, loosely, on a story told by the Buddha. It's in the Devaputta Samyutta. Of the anger-eating monster. Such brilliant psychology. You give it anger and it gets worse. Restlessness. Get out of here. You don't belong. Sloth and torpor. I've been sleeping all retreat. Get out of here. I've only got one day left. Ow, 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 ow. Frustration. I'm fed up with being frustrated.
I'm frustrated at my frustration. Does it do anything? It just makes it worse. You give it ill will, negativity, your defilement, your problem gets bigger, more smelly, and more ugly. So instead, welcome. Welcome, psychosis. Welcome, craziness. Welcome, sloth and torpor. Are you sleepy? Lay down. Welcome. If you welcome it, you're not fighting it. You're kind to it. It's amazing just how all of those problems vanish. Not all at once. They get smaller and smaller and smaller until they totally disappear. That's what you do in meditation. Restless, tired, getting nowhere. Fine, thank you. There's nowhere to get anyway. So thank you for being here, my stupid, crazy, dull mind. So just welcome it. Thank you for being here. Stay with it. And then things change. And eventually you find everything you worked so hard to get and never achieved. Everything comes to you. Which is my next simile. Haven't said it yet here except in one interview. You hear this every simile. Think it's only just in an interview. The famous simile of the donkey. Did I tell the donkey carrots? Yeah, donkey carrot yesterday, wasn't it? No. The donkey and the carrot. Another reason why people put too much effort in their meditation and why they get absolutely nowhere. Donkeys are the most stubborn animals in the whole world. We call them as stubborn as a donkey. They're always much more stubborn than husbands. Absolutely. If you hit a donkey with a stick, it won't do anything. Hit a husband, he might do something. He'll hit you back probably, I don't know. But he won't just sit there like donkeys do. But it's a waste of time hitting the donkey with a stick. Instead, you tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you tie a carrot. So the donkey sees a carrot 2 foot in front of it. And what does the stupid donkey do? It goes forward to try and catch the carrot. But as a donkey moves forward, so does the stick, so does the string, so does the carrot. So the carrot's always about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. The donkey runs after that carrot, put forth effort. And the carrot's still 2 foot in front. Really extra effort. I'm going to get it this time. Only one day left on the retreat. I'm going to really go for it this time. And runs as fast as it possibly can after that carrot. But it doesn't matter how much effort, how much willpower, how much sacrifice of its comfort and energy, that damn carrot is always 2 foot in front of its mouth. Can never catch it. Does that simile ring any bells for you? That is your life. Wealth, happiness, health. You can always see it there. And you go for it and it goes away from you. It's so close on the perfect relationship. You know, and it just sort of falls apart. There's always a problem. Oh, I can't just get it. Oh, so close. But the donkey finally learns because its owner was playing one of Ajahn Brahm's YouTube talks and the donkey overheard how to catch carrots. So it doesn't work anymore. Donkey finds out. So easy. Once it's explained to you, you think, why didn't I think of that? So what does the donkey do? It's already been running fast after the carrot. Just like you've been always running fast after meditation, peace, tranquility, jhanas, whatever. You've been running really hard. Some of you, that is. Some of you have been lazy, but never mind. Most of you have been running hard. They're running hard after the carrot. And what do? Stop. You stop. That takes a lot of trust. Because as soon as you stop, as soon as you let go, the carrot moves away from you.
You think, this isn't working. I'm letting go, but I'm sleeping even more. I'm not restraining my mind, and it's thinking all over the place. The carrot is getting further and further away from me. But the donkey has faith and confidence and trust. And the donkey just stands there and watches the carrot go 4 foot in front of its mouth, never been that far away ever before. But then, at the end of its swing, it stops. And then it starts coming towards the donkey. You've never experienced that before. But you say, Ajahn Brahm tells you this, you sit there and all these things come to you. It happens. You sit there and you don't do anything, and then you become aware of the breath. You don't go chasing it. You just do nothing and the breath comes to you. I say, this is crazy, Ajahn Brahm's teachings. And that's what the carrot thinks at first, but then sees it actually happening. You're just watching the breath and it becomes delightful. You don't try and make it delightful, it just becomes delightful. Just watching this delightful breath and this incredible, beautiful lights happen. You never went to grab them, they just came. They just appeared. And this carrot comes really, really close. The usual place, 2 foot in front, but now really fast towards the donkey's mouth. And then the carrot eventually swings so close. Just beautiful lights, the doors of jhana open to you. The donkey has to remember the last instruction. And the last instruction which the donkey remembers, not just stop, that's not enough. The final instruction, carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. Otherwise it bounces off the donkey's teeth. The donkey's got really big teeth. Bounces off the teeth and goes out, you missed your chance. So open the door of your mind to whatever's happening. Just trust and let it happen. And that is how the donkeys catch the carrots. That is brilliant simile. Ajahn Chah's simile, oh crikey. Ajahn Chah's simile, he was, and look, I really appreciate just how people sometimes think this is madness. It can't work this way. Because first year with Ajahn Chah, he told me this simile. And also, like Ajahn Chah, he would have a simile he would repeat for day after day, week after week, the same old simile. And then another one would take its place. And then you wouldn't hear that first simile again. So this was only the first 2 or 3 months when I went to Wat Bo Phong. And afterwards, I never heard him say the simile ever again. And it was amazing, I remembered it. Because at the time, I thought it was absolutely ridiculous, stupid, crazy. What sort of monk had I got as my teacher? But, you know, afterwards, wow, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That was a really amazing simile. He said his monastery was mango orchard, the mango trees planted by the Buddha. So straight away, there weren't no mango trees there. They weren't planted by the Buddha. You know, what's he up to? And then he said, all those mango trees are just dripping. They're full of sweet, juicy, ripe mangoes. Most delicious mangoes. I like mangoes. Do you like mangoes? You get them ripe and they're just absolutely amazing. So, beautiful mangoes, he said. But, he said, there's a problem. In those mango trees planted by the Buddha, you can't climb up the mango tree to reach the mangoes. You just can't get close enough to them to reach them. And you can't get a ladder and to reach up to them. They're too far away. And if you try and throw a stick up to get the mango to fall, you'll always miss. And if you shake the tree, it will never come down. There's only one way only to get the mangoes from the trees planted by the Buddha. Only one way. You got to sit perfectly still under the mango tree. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall. Right into your hand. And I thought that was absolutely stupid, crazy, madness. Even though I hadn't been in Thailand long, I knew mango trees. You don't sit underneath one to get one to fall. You'd have to wait for days to get one to fall. And of course, if it did fall, where would it fall? Probably on top of your head. Such is your luck. So, but I realized this was a simile for meditation, for insights, for enlightenment. You can't climb the Bodhi tree to try and get the fruit. Shaking the tree won't make anything fall. Ladders won't reach it. You can't even a cherry picker will not get high enough. There's only one way to get the fruit from the Bodhi tree. Sit perfectly still underneath it. I mean, you really have to be still. Not going anywhere, not doing anything. In this moment, this is the most important moment in your whole life, because it's here right now, and you care for it. And opening up your hand, opening up your heart, bit of loving kindness, and then all these things, they fall into you. You go shaking the Bodhi tree, trying to get insight, trying to get jhanas, you'll never get there. You get so frustrated. Trying to get a ladder, trying to find some other skillful means, trying to find a shortcut, trying to prove great teacher like Ajahn Chah wrong, you'll just be wasting time. Instead, just sit perfectly still. Don't run after the carrot, and the carrot comes after you. Brilliant teachings, great metaphors. I should have told you that at the very beginning, before you've been so frustrated running after stuff. But there we go. So that is the teaching for this morning. How to catch the carrot. How to get the fruit to fall. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Now we have the interviews. What? Okay, very good. I know some of you have to go early, so those of you going today, have a wonderful time. You'll soon be back here again. Time is fast. But if you haven't gone yet, don't go until the car actually leaves the car park. Sometimes, many of you are leaving tomorrow, most of you. How many of you leaving tomorrow have already packed your bags? Please unpack them. Only pack them just before you leave. Otherwise you get in this terrible habit of always being at least a day in front of yourself. So don't leave until the last moment. Your body's here, that's where your mind should be. Not back in Bangkok. There you go. Have a nice morning. Yes, I'm ready.
Are you having lunch at the Bodhiana tomorrow?
Have I? I don't know. Who knows? Future's uncertain. I might die if I'm a bit sick. Terry's asking.
Terry's asking.